Someone said the cross is God's centerpiece on the table of time. I like that thought, that when we all come to the table of time, God's centerpiece is the cross of Jesus Christ. And the songs we've sung tonight and the glorification that we have attempted with our voices to give to Him who deserves all praise, all honor, and all glory would only be pleasing to God because that is His centerpiece. In Matthew chapter 26, if you'll take your Bibles and turn there, as God is getting ready to bring this culminating act that all of history has been looking forward to, everything prior to the cross has been pointing toward it from as early as God's prophetic statement to Adam and Eve in the garden that her seed would bruise the head of the serpent and would be bruised on the heel, to Abraham's promise that in his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed, to David's promise that one of his sons would sit on his throne and his kingdom would have no end, and all the countless prophetic statements in between that opening and the cross, that opening scene in Genesis and the cross. Here is God now assembling the pieces that are necessary for this. And like players in a play, like the actors in a play, they're all kind of making their way to the stage one by one to take their places and to start the actions that will bring about the death of Jesus. So, in Matthew chapter 26 and in verse 3, the opposition is positioning themselves. It says in verse 3, the chief priests and the elders of the people were gathered together in the court of the high priest named Caiaphas, and they plotted together to seize Jesus by stealth and kill him. So here the enemies have come together and put themselves in this room to plot the death of Jesus. And then the loyal start gathering on the other side of the chessboard that God has set up. The loyals are assembling. From verse 13, this great story about the woman who comes to Jesus and anoints his feet with precious ointment. Verse 13, truly I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be spoken of in memory of her. The loyals are assembling. And then in verse 20, when evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with the 12 disciples. All right, now picture this. You've got on the one side the opposition all huddling up, and they're talking about what they're going to do to Jesus. And on the other side, you've got this woman who declares her loyalty to Jesus. And then the 12 disciples who are reclining at table with Jesus. He's obviously comfortable enough with them to recline at table. He's not afraid. There's no weapon in his hand. There's no putting his back to the wall. He's comfortable in the company of these disciples. And then, right after that, I mean, verse 20 is only separated three verses from this. And he answered, he who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. The one who will betray me. I want you to think about that now. I want you to think about that. Here's Jesus who's just praised this woman who did this great deed for him. She's in that room with those disciples watching her, and they're wondering, who is this woman that would touch Jesus like this and that would do this? And he says of her, you know, the words about her will be declared as long as the earth lasts. And then the disciples gather in that upper room, and Jesus is with them. And in the midst of that great companionship, thrown in the middle of that is this: one of you will betray me. You know, we just can't even imagine. We can't imagine the impact that statement would have had on the disciples. I want you to imagine that tonight it was announced in this congregation that a small child who belongs to one of the members of this church had been beaten up in the parking lot in the dark after the last evening worship. And everybody is just horrified that something like that would happen. And then to have the person who makes that announcement say, and we have now uncovered the evidence that the person who did that is in this room. In this room. You know, how would we react to that? I mean, for some of us, I'm sorry to say, might start looking around, figuring out who is it? Who looks guilty? I've seen somebody who has a bad temper. I know somebody who doesn't like that child. I heard them talk harshly to that child one time. Somebody might say, it's got to be somebody in the family, one of the parents who got a little too irritated with that child. Or it might be, it's got to be one of the new people. It can't be one of those who've been with us a long time because we know them too well. All these things go through your mind when there's only 12 men in the room with Jesus. One of you sitting here will betray me. It's amazing. Here's that opposition. That's outside. We often talk in those terms, you know. The great challenge to the Christians is the persecution that comes from outside. We talk about how people out there are going to hate us, how people out there aren't going to understand us. But to have that same wording used of one of us here, it's numbing. It's mind-numbing. And I'm not going to go into detail about how the disciples responded to that, but I got to tell you, we beat up the disciples pretty good. We like to use them as bad examples, you know, all the time. They didn't understand. They should have understood. Why anybody ought to have understood what Jesus was talking about? I will tell you, this is one of their stellar moments, that not one of them pointed the finger at somebody else and said, is it him? Is it her? Is it that person? They said, Lord, could it be me? Could you be talking about me? I love the fact that they turn to themselves first and not automatically assume he's got to be talking about somebody else. I wouldn't do that. Now it says when he said that, the synoptic accounts say, and all the disciples said, Lord, is it I? Could that be me that you're talking about? And included in that would have been the person that I want to key on now, because as Jesus continues talking about what is going to happen to him, he says in verse 31, you will all fall away because of me this night. Did you hear that? You will all fall away from me because of this night. For it's written, I'll strike down the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I've been raised, I'll go ahead of you to Galilee. What Jesus says is, you're all going to flee. That's a given. But I'm going to reassemble you. I'm going to go to Galilee. I'm going to reassemble you there. We're going to put it all back together. You're going to collapse. You're going to collapse. But I'm going to put it all back together. And then we've got this statement. Peter said to him, even though all may fall away because of you, I will never fall away. I will never fall away. Now, I've actually entitled this lesson, Peter the Loyal, with a question mark after it. Because Peter's statement is certainly a statement of great loyalty. But Peter will not live up to that loyalty. We know that. That's not a spoiler alert. You already know that Peter's going to deny that he even knows Jesus. He's going to do that three times. I don't want to talk about that part of it. I want to talk about this statement and how Peter could make a statement like that given how he will respond at the end of all of this. So I want to talk with you, first of all, about the uniqueness of Peter. Peter is one of a kind. I mean, he is one of a kind. Peter is a very unusual disciple of Jesus Christ. And I will say about Peter, I heard a preacher make this statement one time in the congregation where I grew up. He said, "I am so thankful that there is a disciple like Peter." He said, "I can't relate to Paul. I have difficulty relating to Paul. Paul's the perfect. I mean, he just seems to have it all together, and he gave up so much. I like a man like Peter who kind of makes statements and can't live up to them, but is forgiven. I like the fact that Peter said, I'm a sinful man. He recognized his own inadequacies on occasion. And yet at the same time, he becomes a most useful tool of the Lord. He's a great role model for us because he is so like us. I like that thought. Here, Peter is absolutely sure of his loyalty to Jesus. And you may say, boy, that's a brash statement to make. I mean, that is such a brash statement. I will never. They may all fall away. I will never fall away. I won't do that. And I wonder sometimes if we realize how many times we've made similar statements. You have. If you've ever sung the words of the song, "Anywhere with Jesus, I will gladly and safely go. Anywhere he leads me in this world below." Anywhere, anywhere. Listen, fear I cannot know. Ready to go to India? Like Brother Jerry has done? Are you ready to go to Indonesia? With its highest concentration of Muslims who are considered militant in the world? Are you ready to go to the Middle East and proclaim Jesus in the midst of Saudi Arabia, where it's against the law to do so? Are you willing to do that? Am I? I'm not. This is not I got it together and I'm telling you people you don't. I'm saying we have made similar statements that are just as all-encompassing and just as bold as Peter's statement here. We chastise Peter. Whoa, he shouldn't have made that statement. I mean, he set himself up for a fall, but we do that all the time. We make statements like that all the time in the songs that we sing. There are a couple of songs I have difficulty singing, and I will tell you one of those is the song "Living Below in This Old Sinful World, Hardly a Comfort Can Afford." And here we are sitting in our clothing that cost us more money than a lot of people earn in a lifetime, driving our vehicles, the likes of which nobody's ever seen, living in our homes, the likes of which most people in the world would consider to be a mansion, and we're saying, "Hardly a comfort can afford. Oh, we got it so tough." And the second verse of that song, I think, while I'm on it, is equally difficult for me. "Neighbors are kind. I love them, everyone. Not my neighbors. I got some neighbors with dogs that do things in my yard I don't like. I don't know that I love. We get along in sweet accord." Well, some of them, that's true, but not all of them. We sing songs sometimes, and we may say things in our prayers, and we may make affirmations in our lives. Which one of us became a Christian saying, which one of us became a child of God saying, I want to follow Jesus sometime? I want to be a disciple of Jesus when it's convenient for me. I want to make him Lord of my life 60% of the time. No, we made statements by our lives and by our words that said, Jesus is now Lord of my life. I don't know that it's that different than what Peter said. But I'll tell you what is a little different about what Peter says. It's that first part. Peter said, even though all may fall away because of you. Here's what Peter said. Look, Lord, I know you got it right about these others. Probably going to happen with them. I've been around them enough to know, but not me. Peter's unique. He's one of a kind. He believes that he will absolutely stay loyal to the Lord, but he is also sure only of himself. I got to tell you that that Peter's statement would have really grated on me if I had been in that room. I think I might have pointed the finger at him and used some ancient version of this. You teacher's pet. Trying to give the right answer. You know. You just trying to curry the favor of the teacher. But it's interesting who Peter said wouldn't be loyal. I want you to think about this. Peter, by making that statement, even though all of them may fall away, I never will, he was saying, my brother, Andrew, yeah, he could do that. That's his brother. Now, you might say, well, yeah, Ralph, brothers are like that, you know. Brothers don't get along too well. They're going to give each other over easily like that. But I'll tell you who else Peter said that about. He acknowledged that that could be true of James and John. And you may say, so what's the big deal about James and John? Well, Peter, James, and John formed the inner circle of Jesus' disciples. Those three saw things nobody else saw. They went into circumstances with Jesus that nobody else got to witness. And I don't want to make a big deal out of this, but Peter's the only one in his family made it to the inner circle. James and John are brothers, and they made it. And how important are they? Well, aside from Judas, who betrayed Jesus and died shortly after Jesus' death, do you know who the next apostle was targeted by Herod to kill when he wanted to start attacking this movement? Do you know who the very next, you know who was number one on, if I can use this terminology, you know, when we were in Iraq, when our troops were in Iraq and they were looking for leaders of that movement, they had them on cards. They had playing cards with the faces of the people they were after in that situation. And Saddam Hussein was the ace of spades. You know who the ace of spades was on Herod's cards? James. He's the first one to go down. It's not Peter. It's James. James went down. Herod attacked the movement by taking James out of the picture. And here's Peter saying, oh, these guys may do that. Yeah, they may be a little weak, but not me. He would discount the strength of James and John. Do you know who John? You know the significance of John? He's a last living apostle. He lived after everybody else died. He was the only one exiled to Patmos. He wrote the last testimony of the Word of God. That's how important John was. Most people believe John to be the disciple that's described in the Gospel of John as the disciple whom Jesus loved. And Peter says, yeah, they could do that, but not me. And let me give you one more. And this one's kind of unlikely for most of us. Because we call him Doubting Thomas. Oh, man, if ever a guy was misnamed, it's Thomas. Thomas was not Doubting Thomas. There isn't one of us, folks, not one of us, that would have heard the other apostles say, "We've seen the risen Lord," and say, "I'll buy that." If I told you tonight, if you'd known me for 30 years, and I was one of your closest friends, and I told you, you won't believe who I ran into yesterday. I was walking in the cemetery, and my grandfather came out of the grave and spoke to me. There's not one of you would go, "Well, isn't that interesting, Ralph? What did he say?" No, you'd be over in the corner on a cell phone dialing 911. "We got a problem here." You wouldn't believe that. Why would we assume Thomas would believe that? The disciples were distraught. It's easy for Thomas to say, "You know what, guys? I just can't buy that. Unless I see, unless I touch, I can't buy it." And you know, to his credit, there's no indication that when he saw Jesus that he actually followed through on that. Jesus invited him to, but there's no indication. He immediately fell down and made a declaration that's probably stronger than anything any other disciple ever made. "My Lord and my God." But I'll tell you something else about Thomas that makes him one of the premier disciples of all the disciples. In John chapter 11, when Jesus is worrying about when to go back to Lazarus, John chapter 11, it says he was staying out in the country because they were seeking to kill him. And then when he said, "I've got to go," Lazarus has fallen asleep. And he says, "I've got to go back to him." The disciples say, "Lord, don't go. They're going to kill you if you go back to Jerusalem." And you know what Thomas said? Thomas said, "Let's go die with him." Now, I know you may say, "Well, it had been nice if he had said, there's no way they're going to kill him before his time. It won't be until he's ready to die." We'd like all of them to say that. But I love Thomas saying, "If he's going to die, I'm going to die right next to him. I'm going to do that." That wasn't Peter said that. That wasn't John said that. That wasn't James said that. That was Thomas. Now, I've taken a lot of time to set up this situation, but I want you to understand how bold and rash Peter's statement was. Yeah, they may all do that. You're talking about some of the greatest faith-filled people in the world, and Peter is dismissing them. "Yeah, they might do that, but I'm not going to do that." What's Peter's problem? The sin of overconfidence. Overconfidence. I want to talk about that with you because overconfidence is a great virtue in our culture. Where we are in America, we love confident people. We love sports figures who are confident. We don't like sports figures who say, "Well, it's going to be tough for us today. I'm not sure we can win this game." We want them to say, "Are you kidding? We'll eat their lunch. I'll tell you what, we'll send them home with a black eye and no lunch money. We'll kick them up and down the field." We like that. We like that braggadocio, that sense of great confidence. We love it. We love it when a football player plows down another guy and then straddles his prostrate body and pulls out the 6 guns and shoots them and then holsters it. Or pumps his fist or bangs his chest and screams to the heavens, "I'm the greatest." We love that in our sports figures. We love it when somebody points at somebody else. They dunk a basketball, hang on the rim, drop to the ground, and then point at the other team. Or point to the fans like, "Yeah, you got it." We love that. Overconfidence. That aggressive arrogance that is ours. I'll tell you what, we love it in our political figures too. We love that. We want our politicians to have answers for everything. Can you imagine electing a man as president who says this? You're running for president. What do you plan on doing about the economy? You know, I got to tell you, the economy is a tough situation right now. And I'm not sure there's any one person that can handle it. I'm going to do the best I can, but I make no promises about that. Really difficult right now, and it's probably bigger than any one person could handle. Man, we can't wait to get to the polls and vote against that guy. He can't handle it. No, what we want is a guy who says, oh, yeah, I got that done. Yeah, that's done. I can handle that. Ooh, that's my guy. What about war? Oh, yeah, I can handle that. What about health care? I can handle that. What about death? I can handle that. Nobody's going to die on my watch. We like that. We like that in politicians. We don't like people who say, ooh, that's a really tough question. I'm not sure I've got the answer for that one. That might take a whole coalition of people to solve that problem. I can't do that by myself. Who do you think I am? No, we like that in people. But you know, the Bible talks repeatedly about overconfidence as being a vice. It's not a virtue. We like proud people. God likes humble people. And you know, sometimes I even think our humility becomes a problem for us. You know, we're kind of proud at how humble we are. We're kind of like that guy who got an award for being humble, and then they took it away from him when he gladly accepted it. Yeah, I probably am the most humble person you know. Humility is the virtue. Overconfidence is a vice. What does the Bible say? Pride goes before a fall. Why? Why does pride go before a fall? Well, because we're not listening to anybody else. We got it solved. Let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. It's about the time you think you've got it, that you've got it under control, that we stumble and fall. Because pride and overconfidence blinds us to the truth. Let me tell you why it blinds us to the truth. Because we don't think we need to listen to anybody else. We think we've got it. We think we know. I love the statement somebody said one time, and you'll know this is true if you've ever dealt with teenagers. Somebody said, you can tell a teenager, but you can't tell them much. Why is that? Because they know. They know. They're faster than we are. They got more knowledge than we have. I mean, there's so much more history now than there was when we were in school. You know? They know so much. You can't tell them anything. You try to tell a teenager something, they go, I know that. Really, do you? It's like trying to teach my daughter. One of my daughters, I have three daughters. And when I was trying to teach them how to drive, I remember putting one of them in the car and she got behind the wheel. And I said, okay, now here's the first thing you do. You want to adjust all your mirrors. She said, I know. I said, okay, good. Now, you want to put the key in the ignition. You want to turn it and give it. I know, Dad. Okay. I said, now you're going to keep your foot on the brake while you put it in gear. I know, Dad. I said, well, then why am I here? You seem to know so much. How come you haven't been driving all along? I know. We live our lives like that sometimes before God. Oh, I know. Preacher can't tell me anything. Teacher can't tell me anything. Shepherds can't tell me anything. I already know. Parents can't tell me anything. I know. I got that. I know. Why did the religious leaders reject Jesus? Have you ever thought about that? It wasn't because they had no confidence in him, because he had given them wrong answers before. It's that they had every confidence in themselves and didn't need his answers. They didn't need to hear him anymore. What did he call them? Blind guides of the blind. Why did he call them blind? Because they couldn't see. Why couldn't they see? Because they already knew. They're like a lot of teenagers. They're like a lot of us. Yeah, I already know. I know. You can't tell me. blind guides of the blind. Listen to what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 11. Listen to this. Matthew chapter 11, verse 25. At that time, Jesus said, listen to this, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Did God intentionally keep those things from the wise and intelligent? No, it's just that they couldn't see it. I'm going to have to tell you something. It's what concerns me very much about learning too much about this world. The more you know, the less you're sure of. You just reach a point where you can't learn from anybody else. You know what you know, and you just can't learn from anybody else. You know it all. Nobody can tell you anything. God kept it from the wise and the intelligent and revealed those things to infants. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 16, Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 16. Listen to this. This is what the wise man says. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? I got a whole sermon on being excessively righteous. You know, you can become so good, you become good for nothing. You know, you just can't relate to the world anymore. There's no good in it. There's nothing there for you. You become excessively righteous. And do not become overly wise. Why? You'll ruin yourself. You'll ruin yourself. Always be open to listening to truth. Peter had to have been blind to Jesus' warning. Look again in Matthew 26 at what Jesus said in verse 31. You will all fall away because of me. You will all fall away because of me. Peter had to ignore that. He knew better. And then in verse 41, Jesus says, keep watching and praying that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. I want you to notice who that was said to. Go back to verse 40. It was said to Peter. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I really believe if Peter had been praying what Jesus said, those things may not have happened to him. I mean, he didn't need that. He knew. And so, not only does overconfidence blind us to the knowledge of the truth, but it causes us to discard caution. We're not as cautious as we ought to be. We know. We got this down. I love it. Somebody made the statement. They said, what is the most often heard last words of a good old Southern boy? It's, hey, y'all, watch this. It's usually doing some ridiculous thing, believing that you're going to live after you do it. Hey, y'all, watch this. I'm going to jump off this cliff. Hey, y'all, watch this. I'm going to ride this bicycle down this cable. Hey, y'all, watch this. I'm going to bungee jump. Famous last words. Because we become uncautious or incautious about our lives. We think we've got it. Overconfidence is the death of a football team. Coaches don't love that. They don't like it if a team doesn't have confidence, but worse than confidence is overconfidence. Ah, coach, we don't need to practice this week. We got this one down. Ah, that's a team ready to go down with a loss. Or a student taking a test. I love the college students I get to work with. I love it. Sometimes I'll say to a student, hey, don't you have a big test coming up this next week? Yeah, Mr. Walker, but I got this one. I got this one. I don't need to study for this. I got this one down pat. And then I watch them when they come out after the test. I say, hey, how'd you do? Not as well as I thought. I thought I knew this. I got in the room and I just had a brain freeze. Nothing came out like I wanted it to. overconfidence. I don't need to study for this one. I got this one down. Obviously, Peter didn't pray like he was supposed to. Obviously, he didn't. And Jesus knew that he wasn't going to do that because he says, and when you've been restored, when you've been brought back, you serve your brethren also. I think it's important for us to pray, Lord, lead us not into temptation. Don't let us go there, Lord. Keep us out of those situations. So what did Peter do? Well, first of all, he fled with the others. When they were scattered, Peter left just like they did. The shepherd was struck, and he was one of the sheep who was scattered. And then he followed at a distance. He didn't get right up there with Jesus. He followed him from a distance, and then he failed to acknowledge him in the company of those around the fire. I do wonder about this. I wonder if Peter had been right next to Jesus, if he had been closer to Jesus, if he wouldn't have had the courage to say, of course I know him. Of course I'm one of his. I'm going to tell you why I say that. You know, Peter made three statements. I don't know the man. I don't know the man. I don't know the man. And Luke tells us the third time Peter did that, the cock crowed. And it says, Jesus, evidently they were carrying Jesus through the courtyard then. It says, Jesus turned and looked at him, and Peter fled sorrowful. It's like making that eye contact with Jesus reminded him. I'm going to tell you something, folks. I'm not saying that sin can't happen right here tonight. It can. I mean, I realize that because sin's as close as our minds. We could be thinking covetous thoughts or evil thoughts. We could be thinking about gossip or even talking about gossip with each other here. We could lie to one another here. There are things we certainly can do. But I got to tell you, one of the reasons I want to be with the saints is I want to be close to Jesus as much as I can. And I see Jesus in his disciples. I see him in the elderly, and I see him in the young. And yes, I see him in the teenagers. I want to be close to that. Because the closer I am to that, perhaps the less likely I am to get involved in sin. Had Peter prayed like he should have, had he stayed close to Jesus, maybe he would have had victory in this temptation that came his way. Because confidence without God, well, that's like Goliath headed for a fall. My confidence needs to be in my God, not in me, and in my relationship with that God. Peter the loyal, well, maybe not in this case, but God blessed him with second chances. And Peter did come back. He came roaring back, and he presents that gospel message on the day of Pentecost, puts his finger in the face of those thousands of Jews and says, "You crucified the Son of God. You put him to death at the hands of godless men. And now it's time to repent or perish, turn or burn." That was a bold message. And 3,000 people heard it, took it into their hearts, and became disciples. Because their confidence wasn't in them, it was in the Jesus Peter proclaimed. I give you that Jesus tonight. That same Jesus. Will you follow him? Will you acknowledge him as your Lord? Will you put him on in the waters of baptism? If you're a child of God, maybe tonight would be a really good night for you to do one of two things. In the privacy of your room tonight, maybe to talk to God about your sin of overconfidence. Maybe you've been pretty bold and arrogant in your religious walk, and it's time for you to say, Lord, that lesson convicted me tonight. I've been too much like Peter. Forgive me. Let me walk in humility. Or maybe you need to share that with this congregation. Maybe some things you've done or said are known by this congregation to be signs of arrogance and overconfidence. And wouldn't it be a great thing for you to ask for the prayers of this church so we could all pray about that together? And having been restored yourself, to help your brethren in their restoration. If we can help you with any of those things tonight, I'm asking you to just come down to the front. Give your heart to Jesus Christ. Give your life to God. While we stand and sing this song, you come.